This is Zoe C, and this is how I create.
In this episode of This Is How We Create, we talk with Zoe C about her upbringing in Vancouver to her transition from law to cartooning. Zoe talks with us and gives us tips and tricks in how to keep in touch and to connect with her audience. Welcome to This Is How We Create. My name is Martine Severn, your host. Today, we have Zoe C. on the podcast. Zoe C. is a Pulitzer Prize-nominated cartoonist, illustrator, and writer with a lifelong passion for laughing at her own jokes. She believes in the power of words, but also that wherever words fail, cartoons can usually succeed. Zoe practiced law for a number of years and now spends her days contributing cartoons and articles to the New Yorker, she's currently working on a graphic novel and making children's books. She lives in Vancouver, British Columbia. Welcome to the podcast, Zoe.
Hi, Martine. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, it is totally my pleasure. At the top of the show, I was saying how I followed your career and your work when you had a Tumblr. Is your Tumblr still? It is still active because I researched you for this episode, correct?
It is still active, and it goes back all the way to 2010 when I started it. I switched over to Instagram as my primary platform in 2013.
You grew up in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And you are a child of, your parents are from Singapore, correct?
Yes. My mom's from Singapore. My dad's from Malaysia, and they're, you know, neighboring countries.
Okay. Got it. So My question for you, my first question for you is, how did you come to skip kindergarten?
I suppose I was a precocious kid. I could read a little bit, you know, I could do some math, and I don't remember this, but my parents told me that to skip, I had to have a one-on-one meeting with the principal, with them present. And he just kind of asked me, you know, if I was sure I was ready. And I said, yes. And so I went after 2 weeks in kindergarten. And it's funny because it's actually like a formative memory for me how much harder grade one was than kindergarten, because kindergarten is just like finger paints and circle time. But when you're in grade one, everyone has a cubby. You have to have like a separate notebook for each subject. And I kept getting the notebooks wrong. And it really is like this memory where I remember like waking up in the middle of the night and like going to my parents' room and telling them like, grade one's too hard. I don't think I can do this. And they were like, well, do you want to go back to kindergarten then? And I was like, no. So then that was kind of my first memory of being like, oh, okay. Like, things are hard sometimes, but unfortunately we must persist, right? So yeah.
So from what I understand, you are drawing since you were very, very little. Do you have a memory as to when you first started drawing?
My first memory of seeing a cartoon was from my dad, and I was probably three. And he's very like musical and artistic generally, and he's not an artist. He worked in kind of cars for his whole life. But he drew a little silly cartoon of himself, which was just like a little stick figure with like round glasses and like one little squiggly hair. And I was like, wow, that's so funny. And kind of just turned me on to the idea that you can draw things to make people laugh, right? And of course, I also grew up watching Disney, and I would spend a lot of time just like, you know, copying Disney characters and copying Garfield comics. And it's just kind of always been my mode of expression. It's always been a really natural part of me. So apart from that first memory with my dad, I don't really remember exactly when it started. But yeah, it's always been around for me.
It sounds like you are self-taught, that you never quite, you know, went to school for this. I know that you've always drawn, and I'm wondering, at any point, did you take classes, or have you always just been self-taught and just kind of practice?
Yeah, I'm entirely self-taught. I never took an art class in school. It really was just the love of the thing that kept me doing it all the time.
How you came into cartooning is very interesting. So you went to law school and you practiced law for a number of years. From what I understand, you were cartooning as a way to relieve stress.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So in my first month of law school, it became immediately obvious that things were going to be really difficult. I had just turned 20. I was the youngest person in my class, and it was like immediately so overwhelming. There was just so much work and so many things to do. And I knew that if I didn't make time for a regular art practice, that I would very quickly just kind of lose myself. And so I started my Tumblr in 2010. And I've heard of these kind of drawing challenges. So I made myself a challenge where I would draw and post one thing every day for 365 days. And I didn't tell anyone about this. This was before social media was like, really like huge. It was kind of like the beginning years of Tumblr. And so this was a purely personal thing. On Tumblr, things could go viral. A couple of my drawings did, and I eventually amassed like a bit of an audience there. After a while, started drawing cartoons about how stressful and funny law school was. And so it wasn't really the plan going into it to be like, I'm going to draw cartoons about law school, but it's where I naturally went, given everything happening.
So obviously you're not still practicing law.
No.
Can you tell us the story, how that came to be, how you came to kind of how law petered out of your life?
I was able to quit my law job and become a full-time illustrator in like the summer of 2020 after the pandemic started. I graduated law school in 2013 and I was practicing full-time law up until I quit. But I was always drawing cartoons on the side. I always had my Instagram account, and coming home and getting to, draw a funny cartoon about being a lawyer and getting that that emotional validation from all of the people on the internet was like a really important way to, it was such an important creative outlet and a great way just to not feel so alone in all of this, because it was just like such a hard job. And like, it was great. Like I really don't regret any of it, but of course it was like very difficult. And in 2016, I was contacted by an editor at Penguin here in Canada. And the editor just said, basically, I love your cartoons on Instagram, and I think you'd be a great fit to illustrate these children's books. And they offered me two children's books to illustrate. And this was obviously has been a dream since I was like a little kid. And the most I'd ever done professionally with cartoons was exhibiting at like the local comic arts festival a couple years in a row. I had like my little table and I was selling like pins and stickers and things like that. But I'd never actually done anything professional. And so this thing in 2016 was the first time where I was like, wow, like actually I have skills that are marketable and maybe this can be a thing, right? Children's books, well, especially in Canada, especially your first book, like they really don't pay you enough to live at all. It's really just like the joy of doing it and the ability to build up your profile. So I, of course, had to keep working, and I just kind of worked overtime to make sure I could finish these books, and it was great. And after these two books were up, I took on a couple of like a couple more authors reached out with self-published projects, and I really made an effort to do those on the side as well, because I really needed it and I knew I had to build up my portfolio. Having my law job obviously kept the lights on, and I also feel like it kind of took away the sting of how difficult those first few years are as a new artist, because you don't have a ton of work coming in. There's not really enough to sustain yourself, and so it was almost a distraction. So I wasn't just focusing on this art thing. It was really just like this bonus in my life. A lot of things happened at the same time. I worked in divorce law, and it immediately became super difficult because everyone was stuck at home, and they introduced these new rules saying that, okay, you can't go to court anymore unless it's for an emergency. But the rule stated that if you had a problem involving a child, that was like by definition an emergency. So all of my high conflict clients were going to court all at the same time during the pandemic, and it was like super, super stressful. And at the same time, I was offered a 3-book deal with HarperCollins in the States. And American publishers pay much more than Canadian publishers, enough to, you know, at least get by for a little while. And so the pandemic and the conditions of it made me, like, I was thinking of leaving for a while, because I don't think I'm really cut out for this, for that kind of work. Like, I'm extremely emotionally empathetic, and I really can't separate myself from the law work the way that a lot of my colleagues can. And so it was just kind of a perfect sign, being like, oh, I have this book deal, and it really will let me, you know, it's enough to responsibly quit my job for, you know, at least a year and see how this works out. And so I was able to do that. Now it is almost 4 years later, which is kind of crazy to think about. The past few years have been such a blur. That was the kind of very gradual process from getting that first book deal to finally being able to quit.
Right. The last 4 years seem like they have been quite a bit of a blur. And I think for you particularly, because so much has happened, you've gotten those book deals. So you also started working with the New Yorker, and that's gone to completely change your life in some ways, I would assume. And we'll get to the Pulitzer part. Yes. As all of these things were happening, one could see that you were playing with different styles, different ways of drawing. Can you talk to me about how you started creating your voice and started being comfortable with your own voice as an illustrator and as a cartoonist?
There was like a very specific aesthetic, especially among, you know, young women of my age. It was all like fashion illustration and like really romantic images of, like, you know, people snuggling together and stuff. And so a lot of me think, and also because I was in law school, I'm a serious person. I have to be a serious artist. And so a lot of my early drawings were of, you know, realistic fashion illustration, just like that kind of thing, like copying images. And it was great. And it was a great way to learn. But it was really just the slow dawning of, I'm really tired at the end of the day, and I don't really have the energy to draw this fancy thing for the internet. All that I really want to do is just like do this doodle of how I feel. I started drawing autobiographical cartoons in high school. I had actually found this artist named Natasha Allegri on LiveJournal, and she had a blog that is now defunct, tragically, called Normal Life. And she just drew autobiographical cartoons of her life in college. And she's now like a super famous animator illustrator. She created Adventure Time, like she was involved in all of that. But that was the first time I kind of discovered that, oh, you can have funny stories and funny content just from your regular life, right? And so I was doing a bit of that in law school, and being a lawyer is when it really kind of amped up, because so much was happening that I couldn't really process, or that I just had to make funny so that I could get through it. And yeah, it was really just the repetition, the daily repetition, this first year of drawing once every day. And after that year ended, clearly I just kept doing it because it had become a part of my life. Whenever people ask about how one finds their voice, it really is just that. It is just doing it constantly and doing it every day. And your preferences will just naturally shift in a certain direction over time. If you're honest with yourself about that you're drawing things and creating things that you are actually interested in, then things will just kind of iterate over time. The niche that I found is like self-deprecating, silly, and more recently, like outspoken and like with some commentary about social justice, because that's just kind of an unavoidable part of being alive on the internet nowadays as well. And also, I think I am trying to tone down on the self-deprecation a little bit, just you know, because I think that also comes from like a bit of insecurity about how to deal with things, right? But so that's changing as well. Yeah.
Who in your life was your cheerleader or cheerleaders? Because starting out and becoming an artist isn't easy as well, you know, pursuing that. And then doing those two things, trying to be a creative as well as working full time, that's not easy as well. So I'm just curious, who are the people in your life that were there to support you and to lend a shoulder?
Obviously, I have to say my parents. Like, they clearly heavily encouraged me to go to law school. And they were like, even nowadays, they're kind of like, oh, like, are you sure you don't want to go back to be a lawyer? Because, you know, it's a secure job and everything. But they've always loved my art, and they've always accepted this, like being a cartoonist is part of my personality. And it's something that they've always celebrated, even though, there was a big focus on academics. There was never any doubt that's just something that I could be, right? In that sense, anyways, I feel so lucky that my classmates and my colleagues really loved it as well. My classmates in law school all thought it was so funny, and I had a lot of insecurity that being known as the cartoon drawing person would, like kind of invalidate me, and make me seem less credible. And they were very lovely, and especially my colleagues in my first law firm. It was the kind of law firm where we all kind of managed our own practice. So I had like there were partners that had like a boss technically, but I wasn't really working for anybody. The attitude was like, well, if you get your work done on your own time, like you can really do whatever you want. So I would be in the office like working on my picture books or drawing cartoons, and I would be like sticking, post-it notes with like cartoons all over the office, and people it was just great, right? And when I got my first book deal, I like showed up at the office and I like burst into tears, and everyone like was like clap, like everyone was like cheering, and I owe so much to those people who I worked with, because I hid the fact that I was a cartoonist for the first couple of years of being a lawyer because I was so insecure about it. They really celebrated me and just like embraced all of me. And lastly, my husband, who I met 8 years ago, has been like my biggest champion. I draw cartoons of him constantly. He's such a character, and I joke that he writes like 40% of my jokes, and I just like turn them into cartoons. And also not a given, to have a partner who celebrates you unequivocally, all of your successes, and is like not intimidated by any of this, and also is okay with me kind of like just poking fun at him all the time on the internet. From day one, he knew I drew cartoons from day one, and he's always openly said that like this is gonna be your thing, like you're gonna be successful this one day. And so even today, when I don't believe in myself, he just has no doubts. And I didn't realize what it meant when people said I couldn't be here without my husband, like before I met him. But I truly feel that way, that it's amazing to. to have him around, and just to see how I have progressed with his support. It's been huge.
Gosh, it's always really good to have someone who believes in you, and to have many someones is this it's a gift.
Oh, 100%.
So I heard that you applied or you submitted to the New Yorker several times before anything happened. Could you tell the story of that?
So I didn't grow up with any innate knowledge of the New Yorker because I'm in Canada. No one I knew read the New Yorker, and I became aware of it in 2015. My university had like a screening of a New Yorker cartoons documentary, and I went with a friend, and I was like, oh, I guess maybe I could do this. So I just back then you had to mail in submissions, so I just mailed in like 3 gag cartoons, and they all got rejected. And so I hear stories of how people submit like hundreds of cartoons over years before they get accepted. That wasn't really me, simply because I would forget and I wouldn't do it. So I probably submitted like a handful of cartoons 3 times between 2015 and 2019. Just when I remembered to do it, I'd be like, oh, okay. And eventually they switched to like an online submission system, so then it became easier. In 2019, I just got a couple of ideas, and I sent them off, and then the current editor emailed me back and was like, oh, I really like these. You should submit to me going forwards, like directly. And after I got that email, I submitted a batch of 10, which is what you're allowed to do once a week. And she bought a cartoon from that one. So it kind of was like very sporadic nothing. And then suddenly I was it, right? So it felt like it all happened really quickly. She bought my first cartoon in September of 2019, and it was published in February of 2020, just like a few weeks before everything shut down. And then during the pandemic, I started cartooning like a lot for the New Yorker. So it really did feel like it just kind of changed like really drastically within a few months.
Would you mind sharing with us how the process works? Because from what I understand, is it that you get a prompt and then you send someone something in, or is it that you just send something in that you find to be particularly interesting?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's no prompts. So, you know, you have to submit an idea to the slush pile. So through like the general submission stage, if you're just like a person who wants to get into the New Yorker. And once they buy a cartoon from you, you become a contributor. And that entitles you to submit weekly batches to be published in the physical magazine. So it's like once a week, you can submit up to 10 cartoons. And then by Friday morning, they'll let you know if they've bought one. And that's just kind of an ongoing thing. And for me, I did a lot of daily cartoons, which is where they're mostly to do with like topical political stuff. You submit it to an email address the night before, and then in the morning, they will let you know if they want to run it online. And so you have to get up, for me, I have to get up at 7 a.m. and then draw it and then have it ready by 9 a.m. And then it just goes up immediately on the website. It really is just, if you have an idea, you submit. And if you don't have any ideas, then you don't. So how much you get in is dependent on how much you're able to crank them out week after week.
As well as how much you trust yourself, right? And trust your voice and trust what you have to say, because some people won't, you might have the most brilliant idea. If you're not submitting it, no one's seeing it.
Oh yeah, that has been definitely one of the exercises of doing this, is just like, there's just nothing to lose. Like either it exists in your brain or it goes out, and that's basically it. Right. So you definitely have to be comfortable. You get very comfortable with rejection. Over time, I also have gotten a lot more comfortable with like knowing what kinds of things they're looking for. And not that I'm altering myself to fit their preferences. I just get more comfortable with my process and my voice within the New Yorker.
And how has that kind of trickled in the other work that you do in terms of getting more comfortable with your voice and your point of view?
I heard this analogy from my friend Amy Kurzweil, who's a cartoonist. She heard it from Liana Fink, who is another New Yorker cartoonist, who said that drawing gag cartoons is kind of like practicing scales on the piano, and that the longer form stuff is kind of like the huge novel, if you will, right? And gag cartoons are kind of like practicing for that. Getting published by the New Yorker repeatedly is, of course, it's very validating, because you're just like, oh, I guess my ideas are good enough for this, you know, like legacy print publication. It also sends a message to other people, you know, publishers and agents and things like, oh, this person is legitimate. This person is able to turn out finished work on a deadline, that kind of thing, right? So that's obviously very good. I think that my readiness for New Yorker cartoons started with Tumblr and with Instagram, because I had spent so many years just like distilling my experiences and my observations into very concise, small cartoons for these platforms. And it was that practice that kind of made me good at doing gag cartoons at the end of the day, right? Gag cartoons are, you know, single panel kind of silly cartoons. And there's, I guess, like a couple of kinds. There's just the sort of evergreen, silly, jokey kind, where they're not situated in like a time or a place. It's just like a joke about like an elephant in a restaurant or something. And then there's the more kind of like topical political ones. And those kinds of cartoons are what I ended up doing the most of in the pandemic, because I already had so much practice doing topical autobiographical cartoons. And during the pandemic, it's like all of the cartoons about my own life also applied to everybody else, because we were all kind of going through the same thing.
Can you tell us about suddenly, you know, going along your business, submitting to the New Yorker, illustrating, and then all of a sudden you find out that you are nominated for a Pulitzer? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was absolutely just, wild. I didn't even know that cartoonists could be eligible for the Pulitzer Prize until 2020, because in 2020, Barry Blitt, who is a New Yorker cartoonist or like an illustrator for the New Yorker, he won the Pulitzer in 2020. And I was like, oh, and he's like a man in his 60s, I think. So I kind of bookmarked it as something that might happen in my 60s. I'm like, that's a retirement goal, right? So any person working in American journalism can submit themselves to be considered for a Pulitzer Prize, but then they announce the three finalists and the one winner on the day. There's like a live stream and everything's announced within like a day or within like 20 seconds. So the New Yorker had emailed me in late January of 2022 to tell me that they were submitting my work to be considered. And it was a very like deadpan, unceremonious email. They were like, "Hi Zoe, the editors want to submit your work for a Pulitzer. Can you please send us a headshot?" And I was like, "Oh, okay." Like, "Oh my God, that's crazy." But then, of course, submission doesn't mean that, you get picked. Like, it's possible that the day will come and then they just won't mention your name. So then I, had put it in my calendar and I was like counting down the days for 3 months and then, or I guess 4 months, and then me and my husband were watching the live stream, and I didn't even recognize the category that I was nominated in because it wasn't editorial cartooning. They changed it to illustrated reporting and commentary. So I was just like watching and like not expecting anything, and then my name shows up, and it was like, ah. But then I didn't win. So then it was like a whole roller coaster of emotions where it was just, yeah, it was hard to know what to feel for a long time. But clearly that was it was it's an indescribable career highlight and an honor, right? Like, I all the cartoons I drew in 2021 were it was some of the hardest times that I think any of us had ever lived through, and I really was just drawing these cartoons as like for the same reasons as I've always had, which was just to process whatever I was feeling and try to connect with people. And it was so special to it was so special to get that recognition and realize that this is something that people really did need, I think. Like, it was just nice to know that I had provided some kind of public service, that like what I made had the potential to have an impact on people. I wasn't doing it, to for like any kind of notoriety. It really was just, I'm like, well, I guess this is my job now, I guess, and I have feelings. I suppose this is just the medium in which I have to express my feelings, right? And like, if I'm gonna make it anyway, I may as well make it for the New Yorker. I thought that was great. Never did I think that like my style of editorial cartooning would have this kind of like institutional recognition.
Yeah. Why not? Why not though? Why not
I
you, Zoe C?
know,
Oh gosh. Well, you've always been so good about sharing your work. Since you started, you've been sharing your work, and now you're sharing your work in a different way through Substack. Can you talk a little bit about how you decided to start having to start a Substack account?
So I had Patreon for a couple of years, which is, was just a platform on which creators can monetize and try to get like a little bit of independence. I didn't love that platform, or it didn't work for me anyway, because in order to access anything, you have to pay, right? Like, even the lowest tier is like $2 a month or something, but you have to pay. And I didn't necessarily want there to be that kind of financial barrier. Like, I had that Tumblr. I kind of missed having a blog where I could do things and people could just kind of check it out if they wanted to. So I moved to Substack, I think a couple of years ago. That has been great for a couple of reasons. I'm trying to move away from like Meta, Instagram, Facebook, just because the algorithm has been really changing. And when I first went on Instagram, it really did feel like a conversation between people who were like reading your blog. Like you would post something and you could really get a feel for who was actually seeing things and feel like you were part of a community. But because of the shift towards video content and content that like shows your actual face, there has been a real alarming drop in engagement. You know, I hate talking about engagement because it's almost like, well, like I'm only doing this for the likes or the comments. And it can certainly feel that way. But more than anything, I just miss sharing my work with people, right? Like if I'm going to work on it and put it online, I just want people to see it. And I'm sure that's what they want too. So that's why I started a Substack, really was just to try to get around that a little bit and just to have some place where people could for sure access it if they wanted to and not have this like the middleman of the algorithm. And I started doing some like paid content, like video content, like, oh, here's my office, you know, here's my writing setup, things like that, like really short videos for paid subscribers. And it was just so refreshing to make a short video and post it to my Substack and just forget about it. I didn't have to worry about who's going to see it. I'm like, I know who can see it and they'll see it when they want to see it. You know, like I don't have to worry that, oh my gosh, if I post it, like, is no one going to see it? Like, is the algorithm, is not going to push it forward or whatever. So it was just so freeing. And so like, I don't have nearly the audience on Substack that I have on Instagram, because of course I've been on Instagram for like a decade and it's just been accumulating, but it feels at least, because right now I'm shifting towards more, the kind of more invisible work of like bookmaking, right? Like when you're working on a book, there's a lot that it takes a long time and there's a lot that you can't show. And so I think it feels like a natural shift away from the kind of constant production that was going on with Instagram. I still love, you know, Instagram and sharing little photos, and it's how I learned to be online. It's how I learned like how to interact with people, right? In a way, hard to move away from that, but it also feels kind of like a healthy, natural transition, mm-hmm. in a way.
Well, if anyone isn't subscribed to your Substack, they should, because it's so refreshing. It's so much fun. Your Substack is so much fun.
Oh, thank you.
I really remember getting it this weekend and going through it. And then I also remember getting some of the ones, yeah, the videos that you mentioned about your, you know, how you showing your desk or your office. And it's just really light. It's like drinking lemonade on a really hot day.
Wow. Thank you so much. That's like really excellent to get that kind of feedback.
Yeah, I look forward to it. Can you talk a little bit about some of the either habits or routines that you have that you credit for your success thus far?
Yes, a consistent drawing practice has, I mean, really, really helped. As I was saying earlier, the fact that I had my lawyer job to kind of distract me in a way really, really helped. It's so strange to think of how symbiotic those two things were for a while, where I would just go and live my life and be a lawyer and have that job. And then I would have all of these things I needed to get down in cartoon form and post, and then I would just go to sleep. And so for years, that's all I did was I worked, and then I drew a bunch of cartoons, and then and it would just repeat. I have a unique experience that isn't like, you know, one-to-one repeatable. If I'm giving people advice, you know, if I were to go straight off of my life, I would be like, okay, get a job that's extremely different from being an artist and then just do that for 5 years and then just draw about it, right? But yeah, the transferable advice about a routine is just to keep drawing and to draw what truly interests you, because that is the way to ensure that you will keep practicing, and to set a schedule of some kind, like that 1 year of doing things every day. It wasn't easy and it wasn't like very good most days, but just doing it really got me into the habit and it really did set me up. And I always tell people that, like, if you just make a habit out of any creative hobby, you know, drawing, dancing, cooking, or anything, like if you just make a habit of it, it will just transform and give back to you in ways that you really can't imagine at the start, which is like the wonderful thing about a practice, you know, like it does evolve. It evolves naturally according to, you know, who you become because of it.
Did you have a specific routine set around doing it every day or doing it almost every day? Did you set any kind of like, what's the word? I can only think of cadre, which is a French word for...
Oh, like parameters?
That's it.
Yeah.
Parameters.
Do you speak French?
Yes, I do.
Really amazing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just, side note, like obviously we're in Canada. I just spent a month in France in November at a residency, and there were a lot of Quebecois people, so I got to practice French. Je nice. Parle un petit peu seulement.
Oh, non, c'est bien.
Oui, oui. Okay, anywho, that's really great. Parameters, no. I had no real schedule. My full-time job took priority. And so I basically just did this in the evenings and in like the spare moments. If I had, you know, and a free half an hour while I was eating lunch, I would just like doodle something on a post-it. I have like this, I don't have it handy right now. I wish I did. This one doodle I just did on my laptop, which just said, whatever it is, you can do it. And it's my face going like this. it's like a stressed out face. And I just drew that on my laptop during lunch one day, and then I scanned it and like I turned it into a print that I'm selling to people, because like drawing that and getting to look at it every day truly helped me through so much. And so I was like, I think that people might want to have this in their houses, right? So it really was just any free moment I could get, and that's what felt helpful to me at the time, because my schedule was so unpredictable. It was just nice to know that any free moment I got, I could kind of escape into this.
Mm. You'd be surprised how many people say the exact same thing, Zoe. We had another lawyer on the show, a lawyer turned writer, who said the same thing, that she would just escape to the local coffee shop, a Starbucks, and she would spend 30 minutes writing. That's it, 30 minutes writing. Mm-hmm. And when you do that day in, day out, you end up with a book.
Yeah.
It never, the act of doing it one day isn't anything that is revolutionary, but it's the 100th day of doing it that's when it starts being lodged in your brain as a real habit.
Yeah, that's what happened with me as well. In 2016, the editor had just contacted me because of my body of work on Instagram, which was just like, you know, years of silly cartoons I'd drawn. And like just scrolling through them, she was able to get an idea of, I guess, who I was and the art I did. But yeah, it was just doing it one day at a time.
So what's next for you now? You alluded to a book. I'd love for you to just chat with us about what you have coming down the pike.
Yes. So I have illustrated 10 picture books at this point. My 11th illustrated picture book is coming out, I think, late this year. But I've never author illustrated a picture book. And so right now I'm working on a pitch to author illustrate my first picture book. Nothing's happened yet. Nothing's official, but I'm working on that. And I'm also working on a graphic novel pitch. And this is going to be a graphic memoir about my years as a lawyer cartoonist. And so this has been a really interesting learning process. And I tell everybody that it's probably the hardest thing I've ever had to do, because it's the one thing that you can't just study to get correct. Like, you know, you can read all the how-to books, and I feel like I've read all of them, I've listened to all the podcasts and everything, and then you just have to make yourself do it, right? So yeah, it's been really challenging, but it's been such a nice, nice probably isn't the word, it's been such a like fulfilling challenge, I suppose.
Oh, that's so exciting. I can hear your brain growing and neurons firing. It sounds like it's going to be tough, but it's also going to be rewarding at the end.
Mm-hmm. I have a lot of friends who have already done graphic novels, and I talked to them about how writing, especially a graphic memoir, feels a lot like therapy, where you have to really understand yourself. You have to, you know, be like detached enough from what has happened to be able to write about it. And you just have to remain really grateful the entire time, because, you know, I guess it's a common thing among writers that, you just kind of sit down and you're faced with an indefinite stretch of blank time where you don't know what's going to come out. And the constant fear is that it could be nothing, or that you might work on something for 7 months and then have to scrap all of it, which is actually what happened to me last year. I did like a whole pitch that was fictionalized, like a fictionalized version of my life. And then I was like, you know what, this actually isn't right. So I have to redo it. And then I scrapped it and I redid it. And so I think that it's really easy to sink into a place where you're like, this is taking too long, especially because I think everything else in my life had like really definite markers of like progress, right? But people who are much wiser than me talk at length about like the beauty of the unknown, and like really just getting to like, of course it's great that in the early stages of a book you can sit in a place where things are uncertain and anything can come out, and how nice it is to be able to like, okay, I just listened to a podcast yesterday which I wrote about on my Substack by Hanif Abdurraqib, who is a poet and an essayist, and he was talking about how beautiful it is to be able to wade through the muck of like bad sentences and find the one good sentence, right? And it is true, like how lovely that is, and you know what a privilege it is to get to be in this place where I get to just sit and just think about writing all day, right? So yeah, it's really lovely, and it's very humbling, and I feel like it's over time going to make me a healthier person, because I'm constantly having to reframe and remind myself that like, yes, this is good, and this takes time, and you know, you can make things that are bad, and eventually it'll turn into something good. Yes, I think right now it's harder because I don't have a lawyer job to distract me. I only have this, and so I'm kind of sitting in this all day, right?
So what do you do to take care of yourself, especially in this stage, right? Because mm-hmm. you're going through something that's a little bit tough right now. It's a little bit mm-hmm. sticky. What do you do to kind of take the load off?
Mm-hmm. I run, which is really important. Me and my sister sign up for a half marathon every spring, which means that the back half of the year we're like kind of laying fallow, but by January we have to like get ourselves back into gear again. And so we're forced to run a few times a week, and that's really nice. And I've been running for a while, and it's just like, it's one of the, you know, just, it's just one of the best things. I just love it. Me and my husband recently started bouldering, which is like, you know, going to an indoor climbing gym and doing that. And that is a great thing that, because me and him both have desk jobs, and bouldering is basically like a jungle gym for adults. And so you get to just, you know, do things with your body that you don't get to do all day. And it really just allows you to shake that up. And I very recently started doing pottery with a friend. It's super fun, but I'm really bad at it. And the nature of starting pottery is that you like everything that you make, you have to just destroy basically in the beginning, because it's like, this is not going to, like, I'm not going to use this cup. I just, you know, and so it's a really lovely art form, I suppose, that I'm not good at. And that's really refreshing. And it gets me out of the house too, which is really nice.
Oh, you talked about some of this in your Substack. So if yes. people want to know more, they should subscribe. Oh, well, it has been a joy to talk with you, Zoe. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much, Martine. This has been such a lovely time.